Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, the world's army of pollinating bees, bats, and hummingbirds make possible a third of the food we eat, but their numbers are declining and food prices may increase in the near future. It's summertime, and millions of Americans are flocking to the beach. But how clean is the water? Some states don't even know. We see a family portrait of a bend of the Merrimack River in New Hampshire. And in our Earth calendar, we eat half our body weight in insects. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. It's rare to get something for nothing, but that's almost the case with pollinators. Creatures from honeybees to bats work day and night diligently transferring pollen from one plant to another. Without pollinators, many of the crops we rely on for food and clothing would not exist. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally reports on the crisis hitting pollinators and what this might mean for them and for us.
For many people, bees, wasps, and flies are best handled with a can of Raid. But these creatures, and many more, make many farms and gardens possible. A full third of everything you eat, and much of what you wear, comes from plants that need to be pollinated.
So many thousands and thousands of honeybee colonies have been decimated by pesticides, by habitat fragmentation, and in the last 10 or 15 years, two deadly species of parasitic mites. So really, the honeybee industry has been in a tailspin. The number of honeybee colonies was at its highest in this country, almost 6 million back in 1947. Well, today, or during the last census at about 1995, we now know that we have only about 2 million honeybee colonies, and this is continuing to drop at this alarming rate. So we don't have enough honeybee colonies to pollinate everything.
Stephen Buckman is the co-author, along with Gary Paul Nabham, of the book The Forgotten Pollinators. Between 1 and 200,000 species of bats, flies, moths, beetles, bees, hummingbirds, butterflies, and even flying foxes, which live in the South Pacific, pollinate. All are in trouble, but Nabham says the most pressing problem now are mites.
Two kinds of mites appeared in the United States in the mid-1980s and rapidly spread from managed honeybee colony to managed honeybee colony and to feral colonies of honeybees, the kind that Winnie the Pooh visits in old tree trunks. And so the mite problem might slowly be solved by certain chemical treatments or breeding greater resistance to mites into honeybee populations, but that will not solve the long-term problem of pollinator decline in this country.
For example, the almond crop in California requires between 700,000 to 800,000 colonies of bees each year, nearly half of the entire honeybee population of the U.S. Now, almond growers, like many farmers, are scrambling to find bees since there aren't enough bees in the wild to make up for the loss of the domesticated population. Pollinators are necessary for almonds just as they are for many crops. Over hundreds of thousands of years, almond trees and other flowering plants evolved with pollinators. Stephen Buckman says it's a scratch-my-back-and-I'll-scratch-yours relationship.
The plants are basically trading food for sex. The plants offer a sugary secretion produced by glands called nectaries, and this is the sweet solution that contains sugars and also amino acids that we call nectar. But also hidden deep into the flowers are those little microscopic dust-like particles that most of us just assume cause allergies when they land on our nose. And these are pollen grains. But as I said earlier, these are essentially the DNA containing, you could almost call it the plant sperm, that needs to be transferred. It's important to remember that bees and other pollinators are not purposefully pollinating the flowers. They're being tricked, if you will, into visiting the flowers by the lure of sweet, sugary nectar and protein-rich pollen by the flowers. And so in the process of feeding, they're inadvertently pollinating the plants.
Buckman and Napham's book, The Forgotten Pollinators, calls pollinators the proverbial canary in the coal mine and warn of dire consequences if measures are not taken. Napham says the pollinator decline has hit the farming community first, but gardeners and consumers will feel it next.
But economists predict that within several years, we may be seeing a $5 to $8 billion a year increase in food costs due to pollinator shortfalls affecting some 40 or 50 crops in this country.
Napham admits this is not an easy problem to grasp. He says we're used to addressing problems of just one endangered species at a time, and now we're faced with something much more complex.
We now must look at the sustainability of relationships, not merely the sustainability of things such as corn production sustainability or apple orchard production has to take into account sustaining this relationship between apple pollinators and the apples themselves.
Napham and Buckman say you can help by planting rare and heirloom species of fruits and flowers and generally being more aware of the crucial role pollinators play in facilitating life as we know it. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
You can reach Stephen Buckman and Gary Nabham's Pollinator Project by email at fpollen@azstarnet.com. That's fpollen@azstarnet.com. Our email address is at envshow@aol.com. We're always interested in what you have to say. That's envshow@aol.com. The global decline in pollinators may soon affect prices in the grocery store. But right now, the folks feeling it the most are farmers. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally visited an apple orchard in upstate New York to see firsthand what the pollinator crunch means.
The Indian Ladder Farm in Altamont, New York, grows mostly apples and pumpkins, two crops dependent on a healthy supply of wild and domesticated pollinators. Rows of apple trees flow down from a hillside and into a flat field. It's been a wet year, and hot, humid days like today are perfect for growing. Like most apple orchards, Indian Ladder trucks in bees when the blossoms open in the spring. Farmer Peter Tenaik has worked with the same beekeeper for many years, but this year, all 50 of his hives were killed off by a mite infestation, and the wild population hasn't fared much better. He takes me to an old white pine tree at the edge of the orchard.
So I've been looking at this tree for, well, a half a century. And now if you come around to this side over here, you can see in the knot holes on that tree various holes that go up where branches fell off. And see where the pitch has come out, the white streaks that run down there? There's been bees living in this tree for as many years as I can remember. And they don't live there anymore.
Tenaik says that apple blossoms have about a 24-hour period in the spring when they must be pollinated or very few apples will grow. It's during this time when he trucks in bees. He says wherever you see apples on a tree is where a blossom was successfully pollinated by a bee in the spring.
But we must have pollinated blossoms in order to have apples. The pollinated seed creates a hormone which attracts food resources
to that particular apple. And without it, the apple won't survive and grow. And the apples that don't have a full complement of seeds that didn't get pollinated, that started to grow, all fall off in about the first 3 weeks of June. It's called the June drop. And the ground is littered with thousands of little fruitlets about the size of the end of your little finger, something in that neighborhood, that fell on the ground that because they were not fully pollinated. It's one of those little weak spots in the cycle that you have to have go right or nothing, and no matter how much of anything else you do, you still won't end up with a crop of apples if you don't have pollination in the spring.
Pollination is so critical to growing apples, orchardists like Ten Eyck have to position their trees carefully. As we walk down the slope through rows of trees, Ten Eyck explains that some trees are there simply to pollinate other trees.
I have two rows of empires here for no other purpose than to pollinate these Golden Delicious. And these next variety down here is Johnnigold, and that's one of those triploid apples I was telling you about. It won't pollinate itself, and it won't pollinate anybody else. The Empire will pollinate the Golden Delicious will pollinate the Empire, but this variety needs both in order to function. So we go down, you got all kinds of varieties. Now there's an insect caught. See that big glob of right up there? One bee came in there with a whole bunch of pollen on him, and he did all the blossoms in that area, and they all stuck. So there's a big glob of them right there.
Ten Eyck had to pay an additional $1,000 for bees this spring. With both wild and domesticated bees on the decline, that price may go up. It might take years for the bees to recover from the mite infestation that is responsible for the bee die-off. In the meanwhile, Ten Eyck says he'll keep an eye on the old white pine and wait for their return. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
It's August, and it's time to go to the beach. Unfortunately, some of the places you might want to swim in may be closed because local authorities have decided that swimming might make you sick from water pollution. Last year, during the summer of 1995, beach closings and health advisories across the nation reached an all-time high of 3,522, according to a report issued by the Natural Resources Defense Council, an environmental organization known as NRDC. Sarah Chases, director of NRDC's Coastal Project, tells us where the pollution comes from and what endangers the beaches.
And what we found are the major sources of that pollution in beach water include stormwater runoff that comes off city streets when it rains, carrying a variety of pollutants, overflowing combined sewers that carry both raw or inadequately treated sewage and stormwater into the nation's coastal waters, malfunctioning sewage treatment plants, and polluted runoff that runs off agricultural areas or less developed areas and that carries animal waste with it.
There is no uniform national standard for ascertaining the safety of beach water, and not all states even check water quality on the beach. South Carolina discontinued its beach testing program about 15 years ago. Glenn Truffeter is director of water quality assessment and enforcement for the state, and he says they didn't find enough pollution to justify testing.
South Carolina monitored beach water quality up until the early 80s and did not find any significant impacts. So they decided to cut back that program and apply those resources to get greater quality of the streams and shellfish areas along the coast, as opposed to actually monitoring the beaches themselves.
He does acknowledge that South Carolina is not in a position to provide assurances.
Without actually going out and testing, it'd be difficult for us to say, well, you know, there's absolutely no problem out there.
There seems to be agreement that storm drains are a major source of beach pollution. These are the pipes that take rainwater that washes off streets and parking lots to the coastline, where it runs across the beach and into the sea. Stormwater runoff, which is usually untreated, is a major source of fecal coliform from animal waste, which is washed off the streets. Dr. Robert Hale is a professor in the Department of Preventative Medicine at the University of Southern California. Last summer, he studied 20,000 people who swam in the Santa Monica Bay. He found that the closer they swam to a storm drain, the greater the chances they would experience health symptoms. The risk increases by as much as 200%, depending on how close they were to the drain. He found instances where as many as one swimmer in 10 was affected. While not life-threatening, the effects don't sound like much fun.
The kind that I think most people would recognize that we found associated anyway, starting first with the distance from the drain, that if you're very close to the drain, you have a higher risk of fever, chills, ear discharge, suggesting some sort of ear infection, vomiting, diarrhea, and coughing with phlegm, meaning a productive cough. So it's basically those set of symptoms, and again, they suggest either gastrointestinal or upper respiratory involvement.
The state with the most comprehensive beach monitoring program is New Jersey. Constant local testing is followed by mandatory beach closing whenever health standards are exceeded. Water sampling is supplemented by daily overflights of the coastline. Citizen groups as well as prisoners are involved in beach cleanups. I asked Dave Rosenblatt, supervisor in New Jersey's Office of Enforcement Coordination, whether storm drains were a problem for him.
No, I think that municipalities have gotten smart about their pooper scooper laws, and citizens themselves have started taking that seriously.
What does this all mean for your beach vacation? First, the beach is not subject to closure for health risks. It doesn't necessarily mean it's safe. Some places don't test the water, and some that do don't close the beaches. There's no uniform standard. Second, don't swim close to storm drains, particularly after a rainfall. Finally, it's critical to keep paved areas clean if the runoff flows to the sea. In short, clean up after your dog and support stronger efforts to clean up and control stormwater. While waterborne sickness picked up from the beach trip won't kill you, it can spoil your vacation. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city block. For others, it's a place deep in the wilderness. For Lena Burley, a bend in the Merrimack River in New Hampshire enriched her youth and was the beginning of her final journey. My aunt, Lena Burley, passed away last month. She was 102 years old. A single lady all her life, she was the keeper of the family history. She recounted many stories about my father as a boy. Her mind was sharp and clear right up to the end. During the last several years, she told me that when she died, she wanted her ashes to be cast in the Merrimack River in Boscawen, New Hampshire. She described a place not far from the railroad station where the bridge leads to Canterbury. As children at the turn of the century, she played there with my father and her other brother and sister. Once they launched a homemade raft and floated down the river a bit. A canoe was beyond the reach of the family of a Protestant minister in those days. A month before she died, we were talking about some trip I was scheduled to take. Suddenly, her eyes, faded by the passage of years and worn through a lifetime of fine needlework and reading, began to sparkle. On my last journey, she said firmly, I may make it to the sea. Heading for Boscawen, I was apprehensive. Was Lena's special place of more than 90 years ago now an asphalt parking lot? Would the bend in the river be contorted with sewer outfalls and the skeletons of industrial machines whose spirits had long since migrated to the south and abroad? Would any of the landmarks, which she described so vividly, even be there? It was a bright, clear day with a blue sky and big, puffy white clouds. Gentle gusts of wind turned leaves on a landscape of trees, very green from repeated washing during an unusually wet summer. If Norman Rockwell painted the 4th of July, he would have cast it on a day like this. We reached the river off a side road below town. The railroad station is long gone, and the track bed is only a suggestion on the landscape. But there stands the bridge. A low chain-link fence and a strip of weeds obscure the roadway which lead to it. Its iron framework is a deep brown rust, and half the railings are gone. But it's possible to walk to the middle of the span on a surface of narrow boards that had once paved a major thoroughfare. The boards have rotted on the eastern half of the bridge, and only the brown metal skeleton is between you and the Merrimack, swirling swift and green more than 30 feet below. The riverbanks are lush with summer growth. There are no parking lots or dead machines. At the bend, a bunch of kids play on a sandbar, one swinging out over the water on a rope tied to a tree, some paddling around in a red canoe, others splashing in the current. As we cast Lena's ashes from the bridge, the heavier particles disappear quickly in the swirls of the current. The wind blows the dust straight down the river, and it dances in the air before settling on the water in a long streak, shimmering gray, yellow, and green. Slowly it disappears below the surface and gains momentum in the current. Thank you, Lena, for taking me to your special place. Thank you for sharing your memories and introducing me to my father as a boy on the riverbank. Children still play at the bend in the river. The water is high now, and the current is strong. You will make it to the sea. And now it's time for the Earth calendar. On hot summer evenings in August, hundreds of thousands of Mexican or Brazilian free-tailed bats emerge at dusk from their southern caverns in New Mexico and Texas, California, and Utah. It's the peak of their feeding season, a time when free-tailed bats are trying to accumulate enough fat for the coming winter.
This is probably the peak of Mexican free-tailed bat or Brazilian free-tailed bat activity in August or this time of the summer. Because they're migratory. They in the fall, say starting September, October, and maybe into November, these bats will be migrating south to avoid the cold of winter. And in the springtime, say March, April, May, they'll be migrating north to take advantage of the insect plumes that happens during the summertime in North America. And so right about now is a good time to see free-tailed bats either as they're coming out of caves and foraging for insects.
Bill Gannon is a research biologist at the University of New Mexico with the Museum of Southwestern Biology. He says the short tail extending beyond the edge of its rear membrane gives the bat its name. And at one time, it was also called the guano bat because the guano or fecal material was harvested as a nitrogen source. But what they're really known for, says Gannon, are the long, pointy wings which allow them to fly high and fly fast. Sometimes the bats travel up to 50 miles at a time, foraging for insects. In the meantime, while the mother bats are out finding food, their newly born young await their return.
The mothers deposit the babies up on the ceiling of the cave, and then they go off and feed, and there may be like 1,000 young in one small area, and the moms come back and are somehow able to find their own young again among this mass of baby mouths that are open waiting for dinner. A researcher, Gary McCracken, found that mothers usually find and nurse their own offspring out of the thousands in this little pile of babies. And it's been suggested that the mom recognizes the young through a combination of both auditory and olfactory cues. So it both recognizes its baby's call, which is audible to us, as well as its smell.
Gannon says the bats will eat half their weight in insects a night, using what's known as echolocation to target their prey. This means they emit ultrasonic waves through their mouth or nose to determine the position of an object. This also allows the bats to cruise around at night and navigate perfectly well. When the summer is over, the bats will fly to Mexico, Central America, and South America to continue their insect control efforts there as well. Ecologically and aesthetically, I find the bat far more interesting than his human counterpart in Gotham Town, who is no good at catching insects in August, who roars around in the Batmobile, which is an appalling gas guzzler that could never make it to South America, and who couldn't hang a baby upside down on the ceiling even if the future of the city of Gotham was at stake. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for program number 344. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer, Stephanie Goichman provided additional production support, and Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for The Environment Show.